Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning into Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, August 30th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at today's weather forecast first thing, this coming from KCRG. And just a note, as we listen to our forecast today, it's against the background of knowing that the hurricane has just hit landfall in Florida today, and they're dealing with a Category 3 hurricane with winds of 100 miles an hour or more. Dateline Cedar Rapids. An area of high pressure controls our weather in the short term, before a pattern shift brings back hotter temperatures. In the meantime, today and Thursday both look pretty perfect late August weather for the area. Temperatures will likely reach the upper 70s to low 80s in the afternoon, with overnight lows in the upper 40s to low 50s. Tonight's temperatures will be the coolest, with some areas recording their first low in the 40s of the season. Dew points stay quite low during this time, too, only enhancing the nice conditions. Sunshine will be widespread today, but expect a bit of a milky appearance to the sky due to the upper-level wildfire smoke. Air quality here at the surface should stay fairly good, based on the latest information from the Environmental Protection Agency, but we'll be keeping an eye on it. We head back toward the heat wave this weekend, with highs on Friday already back into the mid-80s. Temperatures continue to warm into the low to mid-90s by Saturday and Sunday, and likely stay there until the middle of next week. The silver lining here is that the dew points do not appear as likely to increase quite as much as the last heat wave, when they reached 80 or higher at their peak. This time, dew points start in the 60s this weekend, approaching the low 70s early next week. This results in less concern about dangerous heat index values, but you'll still need to take some precautions amid the otherwise still warm weather. The vast majority of the 9-day forecast is totally dry for eastern Iowa, with one exception, a slight chance for storms next Tuesday. That's about it. So don't count on any significant relief to our ongoing drought. Now on the front page of the Courier, we have two articles about Iowa news. The first is record-breaking heat. Crops suffered as Waterloo hit 105 degrees during hot week. And the story opens with a photograph taken of rows of green corn with storage bins and an elevator behind them in the background. Dateline Des Moines. During days of hot and humid weather across the state, Waterloo and Decorah reported Iowa's highest temperatures for the week of August 23rd. The 105 degrees Fahrenheit recorded at the Waterloo Municipal Airport on August 23rd, the first day of classes for many Cedar Valley schools, also broke the city's daily record for that date. According to a weather summary by State climatologist Justin Glisson, for the week ending Sunday, Waterloo began reporting observations in 1895, and the high on that day broke the previous daily record of 99 degrees set in 1948. On average, the high temperature for the cities in Black Hawk and Winnesheek counties was 23 degrees above normal. Estherville and Emmett County reported the week's low temperature of 49 degrees on August 27th, 6 degrees below normal. Glisson said in the summary, released as part of the weekly crop and condition report, that Iowans experienced the warmest reporting period of the growing season as an expansive heat dome set up over the Midwest. Stations across the state observed triple-digit air temperatures and dew points in the upper 70s and low 80s, creating oppressive heat index values. The statewide average temperature was 80.0 degrees, 10.1 degrees above normal. With precipitation well below normal throughout Iowa, farmers had 6.5 days suitable for field work, according to the United States Department of Agriculture's National Agriculture Statistics Service. The hot weather has since eased. Quote, while seasonal conditions have returned after last week's sweltering heat wave. Several daily records were broken across the state as a result of the hot temperatures and high humidity. Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nag said in a statement, quote, "Those seeking to bale hay, chop silage, plant cover crops, or complete other farm work may find opportunities with the hot and dry conditions that are expected to continue into September. But our crops and pastures could certainly use some badly needed rain," unquote. Unseasonably dry conditions persisted under the stable weather pattern, with stations in west, central, and eastern Iowa not receiving measurable rain totals. Weekly rain totals ranged from no accumulation at many stations to 1.78 inches in Lake Park in Dickinson County. The statewide weekly average precipitation was 0.18 inches. The normal is 0.91 inches. Field activities included cutting and baling hay, as well as harvesting oats. Persistent dry weather has put continued stress on crops, especially soybeans, with multiple reports of disease entering fields. Panel recommends cutting and merging Iowa boards. The story filed by Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. And it begins with a photograph of men sitting around a huge table, and the caption says, "Iowa Department of Management Director Craig Paulson and other members of the Iowa Boards and Commissions Review Committee meet on Tuesday." Dateline Des Moines. A state panel is recommending Iowa's number of boards and commissions be cut by nearly half, with the hopes of increasing efficiency and improving the functions of the remaining boards. The recommendation was made Tuesday by the State Boards and Commissions Review Committee, which has been tasked with reviewing Iowa's 256 boards and commissions and making recommendations for elimination and consolidation. It is an initial recommendation and would need to be approved by the legislature and signed by the governor before going into effect. Iowa's boards and commissions have wide-ranging responsibilities. Some have significant budgets and oversee large sections of state government. Others govern professional licensing, while others set or recommend administrative rules. Under the panel's recommendations, 116 boards would be eliminated or folded into other boards, leaving the state with 140 remaining boards and commissions. Many of those remaining boards would see a change in function and membership under the recommendations. Iowa Department of Management Director Craig Paulson, the committee's chairperson, said the group made recommendations based on which boards were effective and serving Iowans. The committee received written input from the boards when making its recommendations, Paulson said. Quote, "If it couldn't get through those two gates, then it started to struggle," he said. Quote, "Really, that's what it boiled down to. Is it making an impact from Iowans, and is it doing what it's supposed to do?" Unquote. Paulson said an overhaul of the state's boards is long overdue. Each board was made with a specific purpose, he said, but it was often made independently of the existing framework. Quote, "Every now and then, you've got to look at the aggregate and go, okay, now what makes sense? What actually should this look like? What would we create if we had a blank slate?" he said. The committee was created in a massive government reorganization law signed by Governor Kim Reynolds during this year's legislative session. The law also shrunk the number of department-level agencies and eliminated hundreds of vacant state job positions. Transparency concerns. Iowa Senate Janice Weiner, a Democrat from Iowa City and a non-voting member of the committee, said Tuesday she is concerned about the way the committee has conducted its work. To create the recommendations, the six-member board was broken up into subcommittees of two members, allowing the subcommittees to meet privately without violating Iowa's open meetings law. The recommendations were not made public before Tuesday's meeting, and Weiner said it made it difficult for those affected to know whether they should attend the meeting or not. Quote, there's a line to be drawn between efficiency and not allowing sufficient input from the public and potentially consolidation of power, Weiner said. Changes not yet final. The recommendations laid out at Tuesday's meeting are not final and still a long way from taking effect. The committee will hold a public hearing next week where members of the public can weigh in on the proposal. Then, at the end of September, the panel will make its final recommendation to the legislature. The Republican-led legislature will need to decide which recommendations to pass during next year's session before Republican Governor Kim Reynolds can sign them into law. Representative Jane Bloomingdale, Republican of Northwood, who is a non-voting member of the committee, said the process for implementing any of the final recommendations in state law will likely be similar to the government reorganization bill lawmakers passed this year. Bloomingdale is the chair of the House State Government Committee and managed the government reorganization bill in the House. Quote, I'm looking forward to hearing from Iowans and digging into the details on these recommendations ahead of the 2024 legislative session, Bloomingdale said in a statement. By the numbers, the panel recommended the following changes to Iowa's boards and commissions. 88 boards and commissions would continue with no changes, including the Medical Cannabinol Board, the Iowa Arts Council, and the Board of Regents. 69 boards would be eliminated under the recommendations. Some of those boards were vacant or not meeting regularly, or were convened for a purpose that is no longer relevant, committee members said. Another 52 boards would be considered or merged into other boards. More than a dozen panels under the Department of Health and Human Services would be brought under the Council on Health and Human Services. Commissions dealing with Asian and Pacific Islanders, African Americans, Native Americans, and women would be brought under the Human Rights Board. 47 boards and commissions would see reorganization or some other change. For many of those boards, the panel recommended changing the membership or removing rulemaking authority. Other recommendations. The panel also recommended eliminating the state law requiring boards to be balanced between men and women to, quote, allow the most qualified Iowans to serve on boards and commissions, according to the report. Republican lawmakers have tried, including this year, to remove the gender balance requirement from Iowa law. Two Iowa residents also filed a lawsuit in federal court last year seeking to eliminate the requirement. Paulson said the law was needed when it was passed in 1986, but he questioned whether the law is necessary now. Quote, maybe it is still necessary and helpful in 2023, but why not have a conversation, he said. Other recommendations include creating an ongoing process for reviewing boards and commissions and paying members of certain critical boards. Members of the public will be able to comment during a public hearing on September 6th. Paulson said the panel will allow for 50 speakers to weigh in on the recommendations. Iowans can email bcrccomments@iowa.gov to submit comments or ask to speak at the upcoming meeting. Quote, Iowans should submit their feedback on the committee's preliminary recommendations, helping this committee put together a well-rounded final proposal, Reynolds said in a statement. Quote, reviewing Iowa's 256 boards and commissions is long overdue, and Iowans now have the chance to weigh in on how their taxpayer dollars should be used to support them, unquote. Quilts of Valor to Honor Local Veterans Saturday in Waterloo. Story by Donald Promnitz. Local veterans will be honored Labor Day weekend as part of an annual Quilts of Valor presentation, but those involved say there is a gap in area participation. On Saturday, Quilts of Valor will present quilts to 11 local veterans. The quilts were crafted by Kathy Baldwin and her sister-in-law, Linda Osborne, in Newton. The event will be put on by the American Legion in Waterloo, and, according to Baldwin, it's an emotional event for those involved. Quote, "It's not just a matter of, oh, here's your quilt," Howard said. "There's quite a story and presentation that goes with it. And we read back their military service and what they've done since and what they did before. You'll see a lot of quivering lips and a few tears by the time we're done," unquote. Quilts of Valor was started in 2003 by Catherine Roberts, a Delaware mother whose son was serving in Iraq. Roberts said she had a dream about how quilts could help soldiers like her son to heal from the traumas they faced in the military. Quote, "The dream was as vivid as real life. I saw a young man sitting on the side of his bed in the middle of the night, hunched over. The permeating feeling was one of utter despair. I could see his war demons clustered around, dragging him down into an emotional gutter," Robert said of her dream on the Quilts of Valor website. Quote, "Then, as if viewing a movie, I saw him in the next scene wrapped in a quilt. His whole demeanor changed from one of despair to one of hope and well-being. The quilt had made this dramatic change," unquote. However, the making of Cedar Valley's quilts have been outsourced to Jasper County. Baldwin explained that the Waterloo-Cedar Falls metro area and Iowa City are lacking people to do the quilting. Quote, "There's nobody in Waterloo, Cedar Falls, or Iowa City doing Quilts of Valor. And this is really sad," Baldwin said. "It's an open hole." Baldwin said there are local residents who present quilts to Cedar Valley veterans, but not through Quilts of Valor. Baldwin explained an official quilt is nationally registered with the stamp of the organization. While she praised anyone willing to go through the effort of making a quilt for a veteran, she said there's an added level of distinction to the official presentation. Quote, "There's just a little more meaning to it than handing someone a quilt," she said. Baldwin and Osborne will both be in attendance for the presentation. Now turning to the sports page for a moment, high school football. Waterloo West tops Waterloo East for the 11th straight time. Dateline Waterloo. Waterloo West coach Lonnie Moore said he's aiming to put banners in the gym. On Friday night, the Wahawks played like it, taking down their crosstown rivals from East in the season opener for both teams in front of a packed house at Memorial Stadium. Junior quarterback Bradley Dean led the Wahawks in their 56-12 victory with two touchdown passes and two rushing touchdowns. West starts its season with a win and a massive boon to Wahawks' overall morale as they get ready to face Dubuque Hempstead. Defense was also on point throughout the night, forcing multiple turnovers. This included three interceptions, two of which were converted into touchdowns. They still have a long way to go, but Moore says this was a promising sign. Quote, "I'm very proud of everybody. Coaches, players, our training staff, everybody did a good job tonight to get us that step closer to putting that banner in the gym," Moore said. Quote, "But it's week one. We made some mistakes that we've definitely got to get the film and correct and make sure we can shore that up for next week because we have a tough opponent next week," unquote. Meanwhile, East coach DeCarlos Anderson gave a brief summary on what needs to be fixed for the Trojans. Quote, "Everything," he said. "We need to work on everything." Waterloo West got on the boards in the second quarter after a 21-yard run by Destin McMurrin, who got the ball to the 2-yard line, allowing Dean to run it the rest of the way. Landon Sewell tied it up for East with a 48-yard touchdown pass to Aiden Muhammad. Dean answered on the next drive with a 57-yard pass to Dorian Doss for the go-ahead touchdown. With the game still close, junior defensive back Nathaniel Klein got an interception near East's 20-yard line. The Wahawks capitalized with a 15-yard pass from Dean to Andrew Klein, making it a 2-score lead. The Trojans were on their back foot the rest of the game. Quote, "We've got an experienced defense," Moore said. "These guys know what the next play is, the most important play. So I thought they did a really good job of that," unquote. West kept the heat up with a 58-yard touchdown run by Ben Frazier at the start of the third quarter. Dean got his second rushing touchdown on a fake before bolting 33 yards to the end zone. Dean's 57-yard pass to Doss gave West a permanent lead. After the 48-yard pass to Sewell to Muhammad to tie the game, the Wahawks responded by showing they too could make big plays on offense. In his first game under center, the junior had a strong outing, combining an accurate arm with excellent mobility. Quote, "I think we played really well as a team," Dean said. "I felt nice and comfortable in the pocket, and getting the ball to my playmakers and letting them do their thing really helped me out today," unquote. Turnovers turned to scoring. Waterloo West defense was as dominant as its offense throughout the game, forcing several turnovers from the Trojans. This included three interceptions. In the second half, Deshaun Kemp made one to end an East drive, which turned into a West score. For good measure, Kemp got a second pick at the final buzzer. Moore said that generating turnovers have been a huge point of focus for his veteran defense. Quote, "Another goal of ours that we want to shore up from last year was the turnover battle," he said. Quote, "So I thought tonight the turnover battle was great by us by taking away the ball and then making sure we secured the ball on our end," unquote. Police seize ghost gun in disturbance at East-West football game, Dateline Waterloo. Police seized a ghost gun after responding to a disturbance at the East versus West high school football game on Friday night. No serious injuries were reported from the scuffle, which broke out around 9:20 p.m. at Waterloo Memorial Stadium, located next to Central Middle School on Katoski Drive. Officers detained one person on felony charges in connection with the firearm. According to authorities, officers noticed a disturbance in the crowd, which caused people to scatter. Police received information that a person involved in the incident was carrying a gun. When officers approached him, he took off running and began digging into his waistband, according to authorities. Police caught him a short time later, and officers found a pistol discarded in the back of a pickup truck in the parking lot along the chase path, authorities said. Officers arrested Dayton Amaru Shaker Bruce, 19, of Waterloo, on charges of carrying weapons on school grounds and interference while armed. Bond was initially set at $100,000. Police said Bruce is not a current student at either school. Waterloo police regularly staff school athletic events with officers. Court records describe the weapon as a 9mm Ghost semi-automatic handgun that didn't have a serial number. Ghost guns are firearms usually made from partially complete frames that can be finished with common tools and assembled from readily available parts. Until recently, ghost guns kits didn't contain manufacturer serial numbers, which means authorities were not able to trace the sale of the weapon and didn't require background checks, which means they could be easily acquired by people prohibited from possessing firearms. In 2022, new federal regulations began to require kit manufacturers to add traceable serial numbers, require sales to be made through licensed firearm dealers, and require purchasers to undergo background checks. This wasn't the first time Bruce allegedly fled from officers in a gun-related incident. On June 11th, police were investigating a report of gunfire that injured one person in the 400 block of Boston Avenue and attempted to stop a Chevrolet Cruze that witnesses identified. Bruce and another person allegedly ran from the vehicle during the traffic stop. He was arrested for interference. police found a 9mm Ruger handgun along the chase path, according to court records. Next, Cruz UNI event planned Sunday on University Avenue. Dateline Cedar Falls. The tradition of cruising University Avenue will continue on Labor Day weekend. The first ever Cruz UNI event will be held from 4 to 10 p.m. A show and shine will kick off festivities with 93.5 The Mix, broadcasting live at 3727 University Avenue, the old Hobby Lobby in Waterloo, in addition to a variety of family-friendly activities. Cars will take to the streets from 6 to 10 p.m. The event is made possible by the generous support of RPM Motor Company and many other great sponsors. In response to community interest, a committee of car enthusiasts was formed to create the event, including Charles Clayton III, Chris Johnson, Christina Yakout, Stacy Johnson, Tarek Yakout, Kenny Herman, Mike Schmidt, and Suzanne Piper. And here in the article is a picture of a lineup of classic cars with their owners standing alongside at the front fender. Waterloo man arrested for allegedly pawning acquaintance's jewelry. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo man has been arrested for allegedly pawning an acquaintance's jewelry. Police arrested Cameron Stephen Hayden, 33, on Sunday on a warrant for first-degree theft. Bond was set at $5,000. Authorities allege Hayden took more than $13,000 worth of jewelry from a woman's home earlier this month. Detectives determined he pawned the items at Money and More on LaPorte Road on August 8th and August 19th, according to court records. Court records show Hayden was sentenced to pay a $430 civil penalty and restitution in May for allegedly damaging items in the woman's home on February. Next, Waterloo School Superintendent receives contract extension and a 3% salary increase. Story filed by Maria Cooper. Dateline Waterloo. Superintendent of Waterloo Community Schools is receiving a 3% increase in his salary. The Board of Education Monday unanimously approved boosting Jared Smith's annual pay to $221,450 and extended his 3-year contract until June 30th, of 2026. Smith will also receive a $10,000 tax-sheltered annuity and a car allowance of $7,000. His salary plus benefits totals $238,450. When he was hired last year after former Superintendent Jane Lindemann retired, his starting salary and benefits package was $232,000. Smith's 3% raise comes after raises were approved for administrators and employees represented by bargaining groups. Earlier this year, school administrators received a 3.2% salary increase. Employees whose contracts were negotiated by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 2749, the Waterloo Education Support Personnel, and the Waterloo Education Association also received raises. AFSCME employees received a 35-cent hourly raise. WESP received a 50-cent per hour raise, and the WEA received a $600 increase in base salary. Those are the same amounts negotiated the last fiscal year. Before the vote Monday, board members met in closed session to discuss Smith's performance during the past year. Sue Flynn, board president, said he received positive comments from her and the other 6 board members. Quote, "We all agreed he had done a super job in improving the climate of our district and his presence in the buildings," she said. At-large board member Stacy Mills agreed the climate has changed since his start. Quote, "He's done so much, it's almost hard to quantify it all," she said. "He's doing more than I thought we'd expect in the first year," unquote. She said both students and staff seem to want to be in their buildings more, which hopefully will help with the district's new goals of improving attendance and closing achievement gaps. Not all things have been easy since Smith's start, board member Jesse Knight said, quote, "We have a lot of challenges in front of us in general and lots of changes in legislation," he said. "It's a little bit clouded on where our school will be in the future, but you seem to be weathering the storms here," unquote. This school year, district staff will have to navigate new laws restricting instruction on sexual orientation and gender identity, requiring parents or guardians to be notified of gender or name changes of students, and banning certain books depicting of sex acts, to name a few. The board will discuss those legislative changes in the upcoming months. And now, listeners, we'd just like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, August 30th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now this announcement. Naloxone, also known as Narcan, could save a life from an overdose of prescription narcotics, pain medication, or opioids, and it works for adults or young children. This nasal spray is available at no charge at many pharmacies. Ask your pharmacist about naloxone. Now, let's turn to the opinion section. For our first editorial, we go to the Des Moines Register, guest columnist Brandy Evans. Judicial ethics in Iowa differ from Washington court ethics. A lot of tarnish has occurred at the national level as the murky ethical standards for U.S. Supreme Court justices and their acceptance of gifts became better known. There were more disclosures in recent days in the ongoing saga involving the ethical standards of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court, or, more accurately, the lack of ethical standards. With each new disclosure about our nation's highest court, the reputations of justices here on the Iowa Supreme Court take on more luster, and deservedly so. The nonprofit news outlet ProPublica reported that the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has received millions of dollars worth of luxury travel from wealthy benefactors without any public disclosure. Thomas has shrugged off concerns about the potential for conflict of interest from his acceptance of these gifts. Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Neil Gorsuch have been criticized for declining to recuse themselves from taking part in cases involving the publishing conglomerate Penguin Random House. Both justices have lucrative deals with the publisher, predating the court cases both later took part in that affected the publisher. Their colleague, Samuel Alito, is in the same ethical stew. More on him shortly. In contrast with Thomas, Alito, Sotomayor, and Gorsuch, Iowa justices have been guided by a different sense of propriety as they try to avoid being seen as compromising their integrity or the integrity of the Iowa Supreme Court. After I retired from the Des Moines Register and took over leadership of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, Justice David Wiggins, with whom I was acquainted, gave me two tickets to an Iowa Cubs baseball game he could not attend. I sent a thank you note and a check to reimburse him for what he paid for the tickets. The day my check arrived, Wiggins had a court employee return my check and explain the justice could not appear to be accepting money from someone who someday might have a case before the court. I understood, and there were cases that came before the court later in which the Iowa Freedom of Information Council and I were involved. Wiggins retired in 2020. Last April, the Supreme Court ruled in my favor and in the favor of two other plaintiffs in our lawsuit challenging Governor Kim Reynolds' lengthy delays in filling requests for public records. Justice Edward Mansfield did not take part in the case. He never explained his reason. Knowledgeable court watchers said the father of another plaintiff Bleeding Heartland vlogger Laura Bellin had been a law partner of Mansfield's, and one of the defendants, Michael Bohl, once clerked for Mansfield. In June, the Iowa Supreme Court deadlocked 3-3 on the question of whether to reinstate the so-called fetal heartbeat law banning abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Because of the tie vote, an injunction remained in place and prevented the 2018 law from taking effect. The deadlock occurred because the Seventh Justice, Dana Oxley, did not take part in the discussion. As with Mansfield, she never explained why, but court watchers took note she was a former partner of the attorney representing the Emma Goldman Clinic in Iowa City, one of the parties challenging the law. The ethical positions taken by Wiggins, Mansfield, and Oxley all grow from a belief judges have an obligation to hold themselves to a standard of conduct that does not bring discredit to the court or even hint at favoritism, factors that would diminish the respect, credibility, and confidence in our courts. A lot of tarnish has occurred at the national level, however, as the murky ethical standards for the U.S. Supreme Court justices and their acceptance of gifts became better known. And these gifts, with a value far beyond a $20 check for Iowa Cubs tickets. Investigative reporters at ProPublica found Alito did not disclose an all-expenses-paid fishing trip to Alaska in 2008 that included private jet travel between Washington and a fishing lodge that normally charges guests $1,000 per night. This was not a fishing cabin like my friend Tony owns, which has no electricity nor any indoor plumbing. The cost of the Alaska vacation was paid for by hedge fund manager Paul Singer, who has been involved in 10 cases before the Supreme Court. One ended in 2014, after the fishing trip, with Singer receiving a $2.4 billion windfall because of the court's decision. Alito voted in favor of Singer's side. Alito brushed aside notions of the appearance of a conflict. He poo-pooed his relationship with Singer, calling him a casual acquaintance. But ProPublica reported that Indiana University law professor Charles Gay said of Alito's trip, quote, "If you weren't good friends, what were you doing accepting this? If you were good friends, what were you doing ruling on this case?" Unquote. Bingo. That was not the same as taking part in a case involving McDonald's, even though you eat Egg McMuffins a few times a year. ProPublica reported that over the course of 25 years, real estate developer Harlan Crow has provided Thomas and his wife with at least 38 luxury vacations around the globe and flights on Crow's private jet and helicopter. In 2014, Crow purchased the simple one-story home in Savannah, Georgia, owned by Thomas's elderly mother. She still lives there at no charge. Crow paid $133,300 for the house and two vacant lots. He now pays about $1,500 a year in property taxes on the house, an expense the justice had borne before Crow's purchase. Questions concerning the appearance of conflicts include New York State Judge Juan Merkin, who is presiding over the criminal case there against Donald Trump. Merkin brought embarrassment to the courts when he contributed $15 to Joe Biden's campaign in 2020 and made $10 donations to Progressive Turnout Project, a voter outreach group, and to Stop Republicans, a group with leanings that are not secret. The donations were small, just as my payment for those baseball tickets was, but the appearance of ethical concerns is not trivial, and that was what Wiggins wanted to avoid. The next editorial came to us from the New York Times, written by Daniela J. Lamas, a fitting final gift from Jimmy Carter. And it begins with a photograph evidently taken some time ago. It's in black and white, and it shows President Carter and his wife Rosalynn together, and they're both smiling, and the former president is kind of nuzzling up against the head of his beloved wife. When former President Jimmy Carter entered hospice care in February, many assumed that his death would be imminent, a matter of weeks at most. But 6 months later, he is still spending time with family and friends, still enjoying moments with his wife of nearly 8 decades. Life continues, albeit under a shadow. As he now approaches what has been reported to be his final chapter, Mr. Carter's decision to enter hospice and to continue publicizing that choice is a fitting final gift of candor from a former president to an American public that has long been uncomfortable with our own mortality. Here in the hospital where I work as a critical care doctor, the very word hospice so often conjures the idea of death and defeat. Just a few days ago, I found myself in a conference room with a man whose wife was dying. She was in her 50s with cancer that had infiltrated her chest and abdomen. Her time was short, a matter of months at most, and she was in pain and scared and wanted to be at home. So I suggested to the husband that we consider hospice. I said the word gently, but even so, my patient's husband flinched. No. His wife wanted to do everything to fight, to not give up. It wasn't time for hospice, not yet. I tried to explain that hospice care could help his wife stay at home, which had been her goal, with the tools to manage her symptoms as they worsened. I tried to explain that this was not giving up, but about maximizing the quality of the time that she had. There was so little that we could do for her in the hospital, ultimately. But all he could hear was a word that made him think of endings and loss. That is why hospice services are so often engaged late, in the days immediately before death, if at all. Half of patients in hospice are enrolled for only 18 days or less. 1/10 are in hospice for only 1 or 2 days before they die. It is easy to understand how this happens. After all, to choose this path is to acknowledge that we will all end, a reality that few of us are willing to face until there is no choice left. But Mr. Carter and his family were able to see it differently. After a series of short hospital stays, this winter, Mr. Carter made what for many is an impossible decision. He would opt for hospice care in order to remain at home rather than undergo further medical interventions, even though we now know he was not in his final days. And just as in 2015, when he announced that his melanoma had spread to his brain, he would make this decision public. Quote, "That is completely characteristic of the Carters," Jonathan Alter, a biographer of the former president, told me. Quote, "It is the way they have lived their entire lives," unquote. Mr. Alter's book, His Very Best, aims to reassess Mr. Carter's 4 years in office and challenge the common belief that Mr. Carter was but a mediocre president who became a great former president. Reflecting on the presidency, he describes a man of compassion and decency who was not afraid to make decisions that might be unpopular, who kept the peace, advanced human rights, and worked to protect the environment, as symbolized by his placing solar panels on the roof of the White House. What is perhaps even more remarkable, especially today, in a country where the health status of a president can be a closely guarded secret, Mr. Carter has always been one to try to tell the truth to the American people. In his book, Mr. Alter tells a story about the time Mr. Carter developed a case of painful hemorrhoids during his pregnancy and had to miss a day's work. It would have been easy for him to obfuscate the truth of his medical condition, but Mr. Carter had no interest in doing so. Quote, "He said that if the global markets think the President of the United States is down and don't know why, that's a problem," Mr. Alter said. Quote, "So tell the press I have hemorrhoids." And his staff did. When it came to the transition to hospice care, Mr. Carter was no different. And perhaps in being so open and honest, he could encourage others to pursue the same path. Quote, "This is intentional," Mr. Alter noted. quote, they know this has given a boost to hospice movement, and they're gratified by that, unquote. This is not to say that home hospice is the only right way to die. Mr. Carter is surrounded by family with the resources to care for him if symptoms worsen. Home hospice is not designed to offer care 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Instead, the system largely relies on families to care for the people they love. And there are many families for whom this is not possible, or for whom the harsh realities of the dying process are simply too much to bear. Dying at home is not the only way to preserve grace and dignity at the end, but for some it is the right way. They say you die as you lived. In the years since he left the White House, Mr. Carter has devoted himself to philanthropic causes throughout the globe. Over the past 4 decades, he has helped to build and renovate thousands of homes through Habitat for Humanity, offering safety and stability to those who would otherwise have none. That work is one of his great legacies, so important to him that he attended a building project just a few years ago, heavily bandaged and bruised after a fall at home. It is only fitting that a man who has built homes for so many others would return to his own home as he sees his time growing short. And when his time in hospice draws to a close, there is likely to be no medical team rushing in, no chest compressions or shocks. There will only be a final breath, and then there will be quiet. A note here about the author, Daniela J. Lamas, a contributing opinion writer, is a pulmonary and critical care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. This editorial came from The Hollywood Reporter. Critics' appreciation. Bob Barker was the patron saint of sick days. For nearly 6,000 episodes of The Price is Right from 1972 to 2007, Barker guided generations of viewers through their mornings with empathy, wry exasperation, and the chance to win a new car. This was written by Danielle Feinberg and begins with a photograph of Bob Barker standing in front of the Price is Right sign. Bob Barker, who died at 99, was the patron saint of sick days. To hear Barker's name is to be immediately transported. Maybe you aren't taken any further than the boxy TV in your living room, the one that was normally off limits during daytime hours, but which became an inanimate physician and endlessly enabling babysitter whenever your body's temperature hit 100. For me, Bob Barker's name is a magical wardrobe that takes me to every student lounge at every college my parents ever taught at, where I would take a frayed, foamy chair that was normally reserved for undergrads and park myself for hours, waiting for my fever to break. Students would peek in, see that a plausibly ill kid was monopolizing the TV, complain that this was the time they normally watched their favorite soap operas, and leave, unless what was on was The Price is Right, in which case they'd take a seat in a different part of the lounge, far away in case I happened not to be faking, and watch for a segment or two. It's idiomatically common to call chicken soup, quote, Jewish penicillin, and I don't know if Barker and The Price is Right claimed any such magical curative properties, but I do know that nothing approved by the FDA has ever made time pass under less than ideal circumstances. See also The Waiting Room at Your Mechanic. More quickly than Bob Barker and The Price is Right. I was not a sickly child, so I think Barker and the show's ubiquity extended to teacher in-service days, random lesser holidays, and the occasional inconveniently timed school vacation. Bob Barker and The Price is Right were, it seemed, always there or always coming up next if you just waded through a local morning news show. At this moment, I couldn't tell you how long episodes of The Price is Right actually were. An hour? 30 minutes? All darned morning long? There's a reason why. When I was very young, at commercial breaks in weekend cartoons, I would wake my parents by standing at the base of the stairs and yelling, "Nona Feinberg," that's my mom, "come on down. You're the next contestant on The Price is Right." Annoying? Adorable? Who's to say? This is my deep and personal connection to Bob Barker and The Price is Right, and nearly everybody whose age stretches across 4 or 5 decades can provide their own similar connection. To understand Barker's greatness, you must understand this. People were and still are fundamentally bad at The Price is Right. In a typical episode, at least half the contestants won't understand the fundamentals of the one-bid game that starts each cycle of the show. Plus, and this is the bedrock of the entire show, people don't actually, as a rule, know how much anything costs. And that's before you get to the show's myriad individual competitions that range from legitimately challenging to glorified exercises in gravity, unquote. You could say that, as the man tasked with explaining those games thousands upon thousands of times, Barker deserved some responsibility or even blame for any confusion. But that would be ignoring the other fundamental principle of The Price is Right. Anybody could and can play. This is not and never has been American Ninja Warrior or Jeopardy. A 90-year-old grandmother from Topeka and a 21-year-old frat boy from Arizona State approached The Price is Right with equal certainty of success and with equal comprehension of the strategy, or lack thereof, of Plinko or High-Low. What Barker brought to The Price is Right was, in many ways, similar to one of Alex Trebek's great gifts on Jeopardy, namely a martyr's patience, but not infinite patience. Barker could smile tolerantly at the contestant who earnestly believed that a box of Rice-A-Roni might cost $17, or cheerfully ask that 90-year-old grandmother from Topeka what she would do if she actually won a jet ski. He could calmly coach that hyperactive Arizona State sophomore not to get overly aggressive with the flimsy-looking game console that appeared to be constructed from plywood, glue, and advertiser confidence. See, when we were growing up, oy, I'm about to feel old here, and it became necessary to while away a day with insufficient activity and insufficient supervision. We didn't have tablets and streaming services that let us watch whatever we wanted, whenever we wanted. We took what the television gods gave us, and, thank heavens, from 1972 to 2007, for 6,586 episodes, what the television's gods gave us was Bob Barker and The Price is Right. Now we return to local news from The Courier. Absentee ballots now available for Waterloo School's September 12th PEPL referendum. Story by Maria Cooper. Dateline Waterloo. Absentee ballots are now available for voters living in the Waterloo Community School District for September 12th special election. Voters will cast ballots on renewal of the district's physical plant and equipment levy for another 10 years. It is set to expire in 2027, but can be renewed now for another decade. If approved, it would expire in 2037. If the renewal is voted down, the PEPL will still be in place until 2027. Levy proceeds are used to maintain and repair buildings and can also be used to purchase property, construct buildings, and pay debts for construction of schools. The ballot language states the property tax would not exceed $1.34 per $1,000 of assessed valuation of taxable property within the school district. The current tax rate is 67 cents per $1,000 of assessed valuation. Passage requires approval by more than 50% of voters who cast ballots. In 2015, the PEPL passed with 81% approval. Annually, the board can certify a PEPL that is not voter approved in an amount up to 33 cents per $1,000 of taxable value. This number is decided every spring when the board approves its tax rates. Combined with the current voter-approved levy, property owners within the district pay $1 per $1,000 of taxable value. If the board decides to go with the full $1.34, the total tax rate would be $1.67, but those changes wouldn't go into effect until the year 2027. Early voting at the courthouse started August 23rd and will go through Monday, September 11th. The election office is on the second floor of the Blackhawk County Courthouse, located at 316 East 5th Street. Regular hours are from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. The office will be closed for Labor Day on September 4th. The deadline to request a ballot in the mail is 5 p.m. on Monday. To receive an absentee ballot by mail, voters must submit an official absentee ballot request form to the elections office. A handwritten request can be accepted if it includes the following information: full name, complete address, date of birth, identification number, date or name of election, voter's signature, and date the form was signed. Request forms can be mailed to the courthouse. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for August 30th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we record. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.